this morning is United States v. McDowell, case number 102543. Ms. Winslow.
Good morning. On December 2nd of 2008, Dondrick McDowell was arrested at 6:20 p.m. At 10:30 p.m., he signed a waiver of his 17-hour right to presentment before a magistrate judge. At 11:30 p.m., he was placed into a cell by himself, an isolated cell. At 10:15 the next morning, on December 3rd, federal agents came back to take Mr. McDowell out of that cell where he was placed the night before and begin the interrogation. At 10:50, Mr. McDowell signed a Miranda waiver, and at 1:30 p.m. on December 3rd, the day after, about approximately 15 hours after he was first taken into custody, actually vastly more than that, but at 1:30 p.m. on December 3rd, he was finally brought before Magistrate Judge Mason. About 5 months after Mr. McDowell's initial arrest, the Supreme Court decided the Corley case. And in the Corley case, the Supreme Court took the opportunity to look at the statutory language in 18 United States Code 3501C and determine how long the agents have to question an individual who is taken into federal custody before presenting that individual to a magistrate judge. The Supreme Court in that case decided, looking at the plain and clear statutory language, that the federal agents have 6 hours during which time to question an individual in federal custody before presenting that individual to a magistrate judge. In this case, the period of time was vastly longer. It was 15 hours that Mr. McDowell was in federal custody before interrogation began. Now, the government has, in both before the district court and its briefing before this court, has read into 18 United States Code 3501, two requirements that just simply don't exist. One is a general reasonableness exception. The government would have this court consider whether or not the statement was taken in excess of 6 hours and whether or not the delay was reasonable. But 3501C has no general reasonableness requirement. 3501C has a very specific reasonableness requirement referring only to travel, the availability of a magistrate, or some very limited circumstances in which a delay in excess of 6 hours would be reasonable and permitted. In this case, absolutely none of those conditions existed. Mr. McDowell was taken into custody in the city of Chicago. He was questioned at 230 South Dearborn across the street. Magistrate Judge Mason was available and present and on duty that day. There was certainly no requirement or no necessity required by travel or any other exception granted by 3501C, which would have permitted the delay in excess of 6 hours.
Judge, was this Judge Grady?
It was.
Yeah, his record of what he discussed about it, he went through that pretty thoroughly and seemed to have, in his view at least, that this was reasonable. What occurred, the delay wasn't that great, and that based on what he determined that it was reasonable. Now, you're asking us to disregard that or at least say it was wrong.
I am asking you to say it was wrong. I'm asking you to find that it was an error of law, in fact. Reading both Corley and the statutory language in 3501C, there's no basis for the judge to undertake the reasonableness analysis at all. In fact, the 3501 has a very limited reasonableness exception to the six-hour requirement. Judge Grady and the government have read in a broad and general reasonableness permission, if you will, exception to the six-hour requirement that simply does not exist in the statute and does not exist in the language of Corley.
I didn't find anything about this Mohammed, his whatever they want to call him, in the state level where he was apparently working with the police, and then
a Chicago police officer.
Well, he met with him for several minutes. What went on there? I didn't see anything about what he said and what he may or may not told McDowell to do.
I suppose I know more about that than is actually on the record. I'm not sure it's relevant. They met for a very brief time. And, you know, in candid answer to Your Honor's question, Officer Mohammed told Mr. McDowell that he was on his own.
He was what?
On his own. That this... Just in response. They met on December 2nd, however, before Mr. McDowell was even placed into the cell at 11:30 p.m. So there was a significant period of time, again, after which Mr. McDowell had been taken into custody, a very lengthy period of time, the next day before he was presented to a magistrate judge.
When was the questioning that's objectionable?
The questioning began. They took Mr. McDowell out of his cell at 10:15. He signed the Miranda waiver at 10:50, giving some assumption to the fact that perhaps they didn't question him before the Miranda waiver. The questioning began at 10:50.
Okay, and then the hearing was at 1:30?
The initial appearance before Judge Mason was at 1:30 p.m. that afternoon. The government further argues in an additional attempt to protect the entrance of the statement that Mr. McDowell waived his rights under Corley, waived his rights to the limitation, the six-hour limitation, by signing what is commonly known in the district court and magistrate courts as a 17-hour waiver. This was a form in which Mr. McDowell waived his right to be presented to a magistrate judge within the local rule 17-hour permission. And the government's argument is that his signing of this waiver, and the district court agreed, his signing of this waiver, in effect, allowed the agents to engage in questioning past the 6 hours because it was no longer required that he be presented to the magistrate judge within 17 hours. And frankly, to me, this argument makes no sense at all. The 17-hour waiver refers specifically to the right to presentment before a magistrate. If this waiver were intended to be also a waiver of an individual's right to have a limitation on the 6 hours of questioning, it would have to state so expressly. This waiver refers solely to his right to be presented to the magistrate judge in 17 hours and to be informed of the rights or the charges against him and his rights. It makes no reference to the 6-hour limitation. And furthermore, even if it did, it would be essentially irrelevant. There's a 9-hour difference between Corley's 6-hour limitation and the local rule's 17-hour right to presentment.
Where does 17 hours come from?
It's a local rule, Judge. I would refer Your Honor to United States versus Sproul, cited in the defendant's brief. It's the local rule that the Judicial Committee came up with, that 17 hours is the period of time. I understand that the federal statute is greater than that, but it's the local rule that it's 17 hours.
That's just an arbitrary...
It is.
What would be allowed in the 6 hours?
During the 6 hours from the time of arrest until the end of the Corley, if I may call it the Corley time limit, a Mirandized and obviously voluntary questioning of a suspect could take place. At the close of the 6 hours, the agents would have the choice to either bring the individual before a magistrate judge for their presentment or to cease questioning.
So if this 10:30 to 1:30 period interrogation after Miranda had occurred within 6 hours, that would be okay.
6 hours of arrest.
Well, when I went, whatever the 6 hours, they didn't do much from the time of arrest until then.
They didn't do anything. They put Mr. McDowell into a cell by himself.
Breakfast.
They did give him breakfast, yeah. Judge. That is correct.
So that's what I'm just asking. In that time frame, if it were, they did all of this some other time, I mean, just within the 6 hours, that would have normally been okay.
If they had done their questioning within the six-hour
after
period,
after Miranda and within 6 hours,
then it would have been proper under Corley. But in this case, they didn't. And to say, well, the statute 3501C is, to my mind, actually a model of clarity, unusually for Congress, but in this case we do have a very, very clearly written statute. The Corley case interpreting that statute and making clear its meaning came out 5 months following after Mr. McDowell's arrest. The practice of agents at that time was to read in the additional reasonableness requirements. So I'm not in any way suggesting that the agents were knowingly engaged in knowing misconduct. I'm just simply saying that the Supreme Court made clear what Congress had made very clear previously, that 6 hours is the limitation on questioning. If Your Honors have no further questions on that issue, I'll move to the second issue. The second issue is the district court's error in denying Mr. McDowell's right to subpoena the informant in this case, the cooperating individual in this case. The government relies solely on its limited privilege to withhold the identity of the individual who's cooperating under the Roviaro case. But in this case, we don't have a mere tipster. We're not talking about an innocent citizen who's come forward to inform the authorities, federal or local, about some misconduct or illegal activity that's going on in the neighborhood. What we have in this case is an individual who is known to Mr. McDowell, whose identity has been revealed by the government in various other contexts as an informant in possibly hundreds of other investigations of other individuals. This individual further participated in the investigation of this case by making recorded telephone calls to Mr. McDowell throughout the investigation. In fact, participated in this case so much that they identified Mr. McDowell as a potential suspect. Whether or not the federal agents were aware of Mr. McDowell previous to this, I'm not sure. I suspect that they were, but in this case, the confidential informant was, in fact, the individual who identified him as a potential suspect and target for their cooperation. This is not an innocent tipster individual who could be harmed by...
Yes, Your Honor. Transactional witness.
It's a transactional witness. Yes, Your Honor. And on that basis, Mr. McDowell should have been able to call that witness. And I realize that I'm running out of time, but very briefly, the government relies on a statement made to the district court that this individual would have exercised his Fifth Amendment privilege, and there was, and they say, literally no possibility of this individual being helpful. I would reiterate, however, that this individual has no Fifth Amendment privilege to any of the conduct that took place during the time that they were cooperating with the federal authorities. That's not privilege because there would be no criminal exposure. If Your Honors have no other questions, I will reserve.
He wanted his testimony, and I take it this goes beyond an identification argument. You wanted his identity. Your client already knew who he was, but you know, you wanted his identity and his production.
I wanted his production.
Right, and that was for purposes of advancing this coercion or duress defense?
That's correct, Your Honor. According to some of the language that's in the conversations that are already recorded, and according to our theory, or one of the theories of defense that we would have presented, Mr. McDowell and this individual had had a previous business relationship which had not resulted in payment to the cooperating individual. Mr. McDowell understood this individual to be the member of a Mexican drug cartel. He understood this individual to use at various times violence, extreme violence, and murder to collect on debts that were outstanding. And we believed that if we had presented him to the jury, we could have advanced a duress defense and would have been entitled to the instruction. I'll reserve my time.
Thank you. Judice?
May it please the court, counsel. I will start with the Corley issue, and let me first speak to the issue of what the Supreme Court did in Corley. The decision before the Supreme Court in Corley was whether 3501C overruled McNabb-Mallory. That was the question before the court, and what the court held was that it did not, but what it did do was limit McNabb-Mallory by creating a six-hour safe harbor within which statements, so long as they occur within those 6 hours, are not subject to challenge under the McNabb-Mallory line of cases. The Supreme Court did not construe 3501C as a six-hour time limitation, and so I respectfully disagree with defense counsel's construction, or interpretation, I should say, of Corley.
Right. Well, the case preserves McNabb-Mallory to the extent that its reasonableness test applies outside that six-hour safe harbor.
Correct, Judge.
That's how I read the case. And so the focus of this case, because the delay was longer than the six-hour safe harbor, is really on how McNabb-Mallory applies and whether it applies to the extent of a sort of totality of the circumstances reasonableness inquiry or whether it focuses on the reasons for the delay or the reasonableness of the delay in light of proximity to the courthouse and a magistrate and so forth, whether it's a more focused reasonableness inquiry. And so that's, I think, the key question here.
Yes, Judge. And 3501C, it is a totality of the circumstances test.
That's actually not what the statute says.
Your Honor, there is language that requires that the district court consider the means of transportation and the distance to the nearest magistrate, but that language is not limiting in terms of the factors that the district court may consider. And the Seventh Circuit construed 3501C in Gaines and construed 3501C as being essentially a totality of the circumstances test, and that's the way that the Supreme Court construed 3501C in Corley as well. So while 3501C certainly requires that the district court consider those two factors, it does not limit the reasonableness test to those two factors.
I thought the court was careful in Corley to talk about reasonableness in terms of the distance and the travel difficulties, et cetera, in presenting the defendant to a magistrate.
I think at the very end of the decision, if you look at the court's holding, when it talks about the reasonableness inquiry, it explicitly mentions that the reasonableness inquiry should be guided by the McNabb-Mallory line of decisions. I believe that's right at the end of the opinion. One point.
Right. And are those opinions focused on a more sort of discriminating reasonableness inquiry?
I'm not sure what Your Honor means by discriminating, but if the McNabb-Mallory line of cases, for the most part, focused on what was the purpose in delay. Was the purpose in order to allow law enforcement continued interrogation? And that's what the Seventh Circuit noted in Gaines as well when it adopted, construed 3501C as a totality of the circumstances test. It noted that prior precedents really focused on that question. Was law enforcement delaying presentment for the purpose of continued interrogation? And in the absence of that, both the Seventh Circuit's decision in Gaines certainly suggests that McNabb-Mallory's exclusionary remedy should not apply. If I can focus the court for a second, with all respect to the district court should have never gotten to the question of reasonableness based on the waiver in this case. The defendant signed a waiver form waiving his rights under Rule 5 to be promptly presented before a neutral magistrate. And defense counsel notes that the waiver form here did not explicitly mention 3501C's remedy. Well, again, as we noted in our briefs, there's a distinction between the right on the one hand, and that right resides in Rule 5, and the remedy on the other hand, and the remedy is in 3501C. There's no need for the waiver form here to have explicitly incorporated that exclusionary principle. A good analogy here for this court is a consent to search form in the Fourth Amendment context. An individual can consent to a search of his or her home and then later be precluded from invoking the Fourth Amendment's exclusionary remedy based on signing a consent form, even though that consent form need not explicitly note the Fourth Amendment's exclusionary rule. And there's no reason, and defense counsel certainly hasn't pointed to any reason why a special rule should apply here. Like many important constitutional rights, and this isn't even constitutional, this is a rule, a federal rule of criminal procedure, it's presumptively waivable.
But the rights are different, and that's what distinguishes it from your Fourth Amendment analogy.
The rights are certainly different, Your Honor, but both rights are important. Certainly the right to...
Both important, but the waiver only mentions one. The Rule 5 waiver only mentions the presentment
issue. Judge.
It doesn't talk about the admissibility of confessions given during the period of delay, which is a separate issue, and that's what 3501 pertains to.
I agree, Judge, but 3501C is a statute that creates a remedy. It creates a remedy for a violation of Rule 5. But in order for a waiver to be knowing and voluntary, the individual need only understand his or her rights under Rule 5.
Well, it's actually a statute that codifies a remedy, a prophylactic remedy created by the Supreme Court.
No, I agree with that, Judge. But the McNabb-Mallory cases, the cases that were codified in 3501C, those cases created a what was then a common law remedy for a violation of Rule 5. But again, the right in question, that right is in Rule 5. And through the common law, McNabb-Mallory, the Supreme Court developed a remedy for a violation of that right. And then 3501C then codified those cases. But I think that distinction between a right on the one hand and the remedy on the other is an important one. And it's the government's position that the defendant waived his rights under Rule 5 and therefore was not entitled to invoke the exclusionary remedy under 3501C.
Has any other circuit adopted that interpretation of the intersection of these rules?
It's to the government's knowledge, Your Honor, no court of appeals has considered the question of this intersection, the waiver question that's before this court. A district court here, Judge Zagel, considered it in the Anarino decision, which we cited this court, and there was also a district court decision in Massachusetts, but those were the two decisions on the waiver question that we were able to find. Beyond waiver, the reasonableness question, I think, Judge Manning, as you pointed to, nothing really happened in between the time of the waiver and the time that they ultimately questioned them, and that's critical under the reasonableness inquiry under 3501C. The district court conducted a lengthy hearing, a few hour long hearing, and based on that found that the delay here was reasonable. The defendant was arrested outside normal business hours. The arrest occurred at 6:30. After that, the defendant signed a waiver form. And to the extent, even if this court does not agree with the government that that waived the right, that is certainly a consideration under the reasonableness inquiry as articulated by this court in Gaines. He was not subjected to lengthy interrogation, and he was, in fact, permitted to speak to a law enforcement officer that he previously worked with, again, underscoring the reasonableness of the officer's conduct throughout here. And then that delay, they wanted to allow him to speak to the Chicago Police Department officer. That delayed things till approximately 10 o'clock or a little bit after. And at that point, rather than interview him at that point in time, they allowed him to sleep overnight. He had breakfast, and then at 11 o'clock, approximately 11 o'clock, 10:50, is when the interview started. If you look at this...
You argue like this should have been told, huh?
I'm sorry?
Should have told the time in between because they didn't do anything?
It doesn't toll the time, Your Honor, but those factors are certainly factors that provide clear support for the proposition that the district court did not commit clear error in finding that the delay by law enforcement was reasonable.
I take it that it's common practice in the Northern District that after law enforcement gets one of these 17-hour Rule 5 waivers, that it takes advantage of all 17 hours.
What the record states in this case is that what the officers testified to is that, yes, Judge, it is common after hours when a defendant is arrested after normal business hour, it is common for officers to ask for that 17-hour waiver so that a magistrate judge need not come in the middle of the night in order to comply with. And Your Honor asked the...
Right. That's not really the import of my question. It's that once the waiver is in hand, that law enforcement takes the full 17 hours and does what it wishes, including interrogate the defendant, reliance on that waiver. Is that a fair statement or no?
I would certainly say that law enforcement relied on the fact of the waiver in not presenting the defendant within 17 hours.
Okay, so law enforcement and the U.S. Attorney's Office here is taking the position that that waiver clears both Rule 5 problems and 3501 problems and McNabb-Mallory problems.
Yes, Judge. It's again, it's the government's position that in signing that form, he waived his right to prompt presentment. He still has a right to be presented. It's just he waived the time.
Right. So the government takes the position that any, you know, defendant who signs off on one of those Rule 5 waivers also is signing off on any suppression remedy for anything he might say during any interrogation that occurs during that 17-hour window.
No, Judge. Certainly that's not the case. There are other constitutional limitations. There's Miranda. There is voluntariness.
Right, setting aside Miranda and voluntariness, which are a given. But okay, set those aside. Is that, in fact, the position of the Justice Department in this district?
The position of the government is that if the defendant waives his right to prompt presentment under Rule 5, that he cannot invoke the exclusionary remedy of 3501C.
Or McNabb-Mallory.
Or McNabb-Mallory, which is one and the same.
So it's just about presentment, then?
Yes, Judge. Rule 5 simply deals with the question of presentment.
Okay, so that Rule 5 waiver form in the government's position constitutes a waiver of prompt presentment?
Yes, Judge.
Under the rule and the common law and also the suppression remedy for any self-incriminating statements given during that window, which is an entirely different constitutional doctrine.
Well, again, just to be clear, the sole waiver in question is a waiver of the right to prompt presentment. And what 3501C does is it provides a remedy for that, and it excludes statements in certain instances if made outside 6 hours, if that delay was not reasonable. It's the government's position that that one remedy under 3501C, if a defendant signs a Rule 5 waiver form, then the government's position is yes, they are not entitled to invoke that exclusionary remedy under 3501C.
Statutory matter and as a constitutional matter? That's a waiver of a constitutional right, even though it doesn't mention it.
No, I don't think there's a it's the government's position there's not a constitutional right in play.
A Supreme Court remedy that survived the enactment of the statute, that's what Corley tells us, right?
Right.
That protects not only the defendant's right to fair presentment, prompt presentment, but also the defendant's self-incrimination right.
I don't think that self-incrimination, I think, and the constitutional right against compelled self-incrimination, that's something entirely distinct in the government's view from what Rule 5 and 3501C deal with.
Right. There's no question that it is, but the constitutional supervisory rule that the Supreme Court created implicates both.
I think our brief lays out how Corley discusses the chronology, but the right to prompt presentment was not constitutional. It was a common law.
Right.
Yeah, it was
right.
Common law. And so ultimately that's codified in Rule 5. And then once Rule 5 is there, again through the common law, the Supreme Court creates this remedy under the McNabb-Mallory line of cases. It's the government's view in no way are there the constitutional rights in play. It's simply...
It has nothing to do with voluntariness.
Not voluntariness in the Fifth Amendment sense, Judge. Certainly the concern with prompt presentment, if you were to look at the concerns that underlie the adoption of that, voluntariness is one of the concerns underlying that, but not voluntariness in the Fifth Amendment constitutional sense.
Well, what other sense is there for our purposes?
I misspoke. It's the government's position that there is not a constitutional right that is waived in signing a Rule 5 form. It's simply that they waive the statutory right in 3501C to exclude statements.
Well, you also are implicitly taking the position that the McNabb-Mallory argument, whether that's of constitutional stature or not, is also being waived. That is implicit in your argument.
Yes, Judge, that the right to invoke the remedy under McNabb-Mallory is waived.
Okay, and you disagree that McNabb-Mallory is the constitutional rule?
Yes, Judge.
Okay.
I see that my time is up. Unless the panel has any questions, we would respectfully request that the court affirm the conviction in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Winslow.
18 United States Code 3501 governs the admissibility of confessions. In fact, this is not a statute that deals with presentment. That's Rule 5. And I believe that the government, in its argument that the waiver governs both the remedy stated in Section C of 3501 and the waiver of the right to presentment in Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 5, mixes up two very distinct issues. In response to Judge Sykes, your question, it is the common practice of the agents to take advantage of every minute of the 17 hours and beyond if given.
Rise if it wasn't.
Well, and I'd again refer, Your Honor, to United States versus Sproul, which unfortunately I was counsel in that matter, but and for some guidance on what the federal agents will do if given the opportunity to have 17 hours or beyond to question an individual. When Mr. McDowell was taken into custody and he was placed in a cell overnight by himself, to wonder what was going to happen, to wonder what the charges would be against him, to wonder whether or not he would be charged or his cooperation would in some way benefit him, there was in fact some prejudice that resulted from that. He had that period of time to wonder without having the opportunity to be presented before a judge.
What is the status of the McNabb-Mallory rule?
Judge, I believe that the status of the McNabb-Mallory rule is just as stated in 3501C, which is that there is a remedy, there is an exclusion remedy for statements taken outside of the six-hour rule. It does not provide, my reading of the cases does not provide a general reasonableness inquiry.
I guess my question gets at the status as a constitutional matter.
It's my position. I think I agree with the government that it's a statutory issue. Nonetheless, I disagree with the government strongly that the 17-hour waiver is inclusive of all rights that a defendant has during that time. In order to waive any right, be it statutory or constitutional, there has to be some knowledge that you're waiving that right. There has to be an informed waiver.
So McNabb-Mallory doesn't essentially imply that confessions given in violation of the prompt presentment rule at common law have a taint of involuntariness?
It does. It does imply.
It does imply that.
It does imply a voluntary.
So in that sense, it is a constitutional ruling?
In that sense, it is a constitutional rule, but I think that implication goes beyond where this court needs to reach in this case, because there is a statutory analysis that would resolve the issue. In the interest of constitutional avoidance.
Well, right, but if it has constitutional stature, then it's a whole different kettle of fish in terms of waiver.
It absolutely is, I agree with that. I believe, and it's our position, that Mr. McDowell's waiver was inadequate for a statutory right and particularly inadequate for a constitutional right. It certainly wasn't knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. If the court has no further questions, I would ask that you reverse this case, remand to the district court.
Thank you.
Thank
Our
you,
thanks
Ma.
To both counsel for excellent arguments. The case is taken under advisement.